Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Many creatives took the last 2 years of the pandemic to take a breath or a break, but not Judd Apatow. Judd Apatow, the writer-director, made a meta-comedy titled The Bubble about the making of a super cheesy action film during a quarantine. Judd Apatow, the filmmaker, has an upcoming documentary about comedian George Carlin. And Judd Apatow, the writer, has a new book, Sicker in the Head, More Conversations About Life and Comedy. It's a follow-up to his best-selling book, Sick in the Head. Yes, they are all the same Judd, who people might know these days as Maude's dad. His daughter is one of the stars of HBO's Euphoria, and his other daughter, Iris, and his wife, the great actor Leslie Mann, are both in the film The Bubble, as is actor David Duchovny, who will join us in just a little bit. But first, let's dive into Judd Apatow's book, a fascinating collection of interviews with creative and passionate people like fellow comic writers Amber Ruffin and Bowen Yang, but also folks like musician Jeff Tweedy and TV host Gail King. They all get very candid, as does Judd. Judd Apatow, welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. You write in the intro of your book, you write, many of these conversations became way more personal and honest than they otherwise might have been because we were in this vulnerable, raw space together. Once you realized there was this vulnerability, how did it change the rhythm of the interviews?
Well, I think in normal times, people are very driven by their egos and their careers and how they can get ahead. And during the pandemic, there's this pause where all of us thought, how are we feeling about our lives and our jobs and our journeys and our relationships? Mm-hmm. And whether we wanted to or not, I think everybody got very introspective. So it was a great time to talk to people and talk about comedy. But really what I'm saying is, how are you doing? You know, what's your journey been like? Mm-hmm. Why did you get creative? What happened to you? How are you maintaining your career and your sanity? And I think people were just very frank.
Isn't it interesting how that simple question, how are you doing, became so so much deeper than normal, you know?
It opens up the whole thing. It's like when you ask someone a question, if they really listen to the question, they might fall apart, right? If you just said, like, how are you holding up? Like, some people like go, I'm fine. But if you really went there, you might just be in tears for 10 minutes.
Were you feeling that same sense of vulnerability?
I definitely was. I wanted to talk to people probably because I needed to make connections with with others. My world had dropped out. So I'm sure on some unconscious level, I thought, I'm really lonely and freaking out in my home. I can only play so many board games. And it would be nice to talk to Whoopi Goldberg right now.
One of the things that stood out to me about some of these conversations was how someone's background, who they are, even if they try to maybe leave it behind, it's infused in their work. There's this great conversation with Bowen Yang where he discusses how he was a crack-up at school, but he went home to his parents who grew up in communist China and he wasn't considered so funny at home. And he was a shy kid at home. First of all, have you found that with yourself, that you bring you with you to your writing?
Well, I think you want to be seen as a kid, especially for kids who are different. Maybe you don't fit into how society works and how school works. I mean, if you're not an athlete, if you're not having the same type of situation with hanging with a popular crowd, you look for a way to express yourself and to find the thing that makes you special. I remember when I was a kid, I always thought, this is not my time, but I will have my time. And it's going to be much later. I really knew that as a little kid, that I was interested in comedy. No one likes comedy. No one even cared when I was a kid. But I thought, when I get into my 20s, I think there's an industry and there are people out there and I will find them.
That's really mature for a little guy to figure out.
That's a weird little guy. That's for sure.
My guest is Judd Apatow. We're talking about his book, Sicker in the Head, More Conversations About Life and Comedy. What was a conversation you had that really led you to something that you really had never thought about before?
Well, I think as a kid, I started doing these interviews when I was 15 for my high school radio station, really as a way to try to just learn about comedy and figure out how I might be able to get into it. And the one thing that people said was it takes about 7 years to find your onstage persona, to get to know yourself enough to be a good comedian. And as a, you know, as someone who's 16 or 15, that's incredible advice, because I think everyone wants to be famous instantly. They want to be successful instantly. So now with TikTok and Instagram, everyone is trying to find a way to be, you know, a star. And it was great for someone to go, no, it takes a really long time. And it set my clock for a certain kind of patience that allowed me to understand that it would take a long time to figure it out.
Now, you know, I have to ask you about radio as a kid.
Yes. Yes. Tell radio. Us. I love radio.
Come on. We're live on the radio. Tell me about your earliest radio days.
I started working at WKWZ Radio, the Syosset High School radio station, 88.5, for those of you within 2 miles of the school. And my friend Josh Rosenthal used to interview bands. He would go interview REM or Jeff Buckley. And then one day he's like, you should try to interview comics. And the guy that ran the radio station was a teacher of media at the school named Jack DeMacy, you know, who went to film school with Martin Scorsese at NYU. And he was this really funny, brilliant guy, still is. And he treated us like adults at the radio station. So it was like playtime, but we were interviewing congressmen and we were, you know, reviewing Ray Charles concerts and, you know, DJing jazz. I was a jazz DJ for years. And then I tried to imitate Howard Stern for a long time. And it was a way to pretend to be an adult and get a sense of how the world worked. And it was life-changing for a lot of people who worked there.
Sounds like it was important to you too.
It really made me think my dreams were possible. You know, when I would meet someone like Jerry Seinfeld or Paul Reiser very early in their careers, I thought, oh, I see that there's a process to do this. You go to open mic nights and you write jokes, and they would tell me how to write jokes. And because they were like me, they were just other people from Long Island, the magic of people in show business went away. And I noticed, oh, this is a job, and you work really hard and you do the things to prepare yourself and educate yourself to do it well.
What follows under what falls under the heading of working really hard early in someone's comedy career?
Well, for me, what I did is I got a job at a comedy club as a dishwasher because I just wanted to be around it. And I would go to the East Side Comedy Club in Huntington, and Rosie O'Donnell was just getting started. Eddie Murphy was still coming in, and I would just get to be around comics and the business. And then I realized I couldn't see the show much because I was washing dishes. I was in the kitchen. I'm in the wrong room. So I switched to busboy so I could watch the shows. And then I interviewed about 50 comedians. And then at some point you go to an open mic night where anyone can get on stage and you're terrible and you have to prepare yourself to be bad for a long time. It's this weird profession where you only can learn how to do it by doing it and getting past being awful.
What did you learn from some of the people you spoke with about that idea that you do have to fail? And in this job, your job as a stand-up comic, sometimes with live radio, you have to fail publicly to get better.
Yeah, I mean, just knowing that they were bad too meant a lot to me. Just knowing that the early days of some of my favorite comedians were filled with terrible, humiliating bombs. I mean, there's a thing that Jerry Lewis used to say, which is you learn nothing about how to be funny by getting laughs. You only learn by not getting laughs. And I used to say that on stage at the end of a set where I bombed and I would get a big laugh. And then I would say, and I got a college education tonight. But I do think that's true. You learn just as much from the wipeouts as from the big laughs.
My guest is Judd Apatow. We're talking about his book, Sicker in the Head, More Conversations About Life and Comedy. The first conversation of the book is with Amber Ruffin. What do you admire about what Amber's been able to do with her career?
Well, Amber, came from, you know, a town in the Midwest and started doing, you know, improv and comedy. And at some point she, you know, went to Chicago for a comedy festival. And she told me that she didn't think that something gigantic would happen. She was interested in it, but I don't know if she had a vision for what you could do. And then she went to a place in Amsterdam where people like Jason Sudeikis got started. And for years, like many, many years, did improv at a place called Boom Chicago, which is in Amsterdam, and did comedy for tourists and people from around the world for many, many years, and learned her craft and became insanely funny, and you know, turned that into you know, what she does now, which is writing and performing on Seth Meyers and her own show on Peacock. And a lot of people have these like strange paths to figuring out who they are and what is the best expression of their point of view. What setting is the best place for somebody?
The book is really also very open. You're very open. Some of the people you talk to are very open about mental health, about seeking therapy, about medication to help get through certain parts of their lives. You know, Pete Davidson's been really open about it, Hannah Gadsby. What did you hear in these conversations about why people are feeling called to talk about mental health, specifically comedians?
The first person I talked to about this in depth was someone whose HBO special I produced named Chris Gethard, who's a great comedian, and he had a show, The Chris Gethard Show. He had a show he was performing called Career Suicide, which was about his mental health struggles and suicide attempts. And we did that as an HBO special. And afterwards, he got tens of thousands of messages on Facebook and other places from people who said, I've never seen anything where someone talks openly about what it's like and shows the potential for hope and how you can heal and survive. And we felt that that was really important. In addition to the show being very funny and entertaining, it was a way to say to people, you're not alone in this. Then I produced Gary Gulman's special called The Great Depression. We had a very similar reaction to it. I think there are certain ideas that aren't always seen in the culture that much. And the more people talk about mental health, the more people feel better, feel like it's something that they can manage and can find solutions. So it's really important that isn't something that people try to hide.
My guest is Judd Apatow. We've been talking about his book, Sicker in the Head, More Conversations About Life and Comedy. It is out now. You have this George Carlin documentary in the works, or is it done?
I do. We have a two-part George Carlin documentary that will be on HBO in late May. And I directed it with my friend Michael Bonfiglio, who produced the Gary Shandling documentary for me. And it's a really deep dive into George Carlin, because most people don't know anything about his life. Mm-hmm. He didn't talk about anything personal on stage ever. That just wasn't his approach. But what we noticed was that during every major current event, his name starts trending, because even 10, 20, 30 years ago, he had the best take on it, the best routine about it. And unlike most comedians whose stuff ages very badly, his material seems to get better and better and more on point. So the documentary is about both his personal struggles, but also how he changed decade to decade to stay current.
It's such an interesting, you know, it's an interesting conversation. How, with comedy, as culture evolves and morphs and changes, does comedy have to go with it? Because there are certain jokes, my old fat wife joke doesn't play now, right? And nor should it.
Yeah, things change, and comedy holds more. It used to be, you know, a lot of like funny white, often Jewish men with a similar type of attitude who started doing comedy in the Borscht Belts, and then it became deeper with people like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, and people got more personal, and you had people like Alan King and Robert Klein, and then it turned into Seinfeld and Paul Reiser and Richard Lewis and Elaine Boozler, and then it opened up more with people like Joan Rivers and my grandma's buddy Tody Fields, and I think it's evolved now to be deeply personal. Much like Richard Pryor was a very personal comedian, but now I think comedians have podcasts and they go on the road and people know who they are. They know everything about their lives. And there's a very, very deep relationship between the crowd and comedians, like someone like Gary Goldman, who is opening up as much as a person can open up. Pete Davidson does that. And I think that that's a great thing about comedy. One of the interviews in the book is with Rami Youssef, who has mm-hmm. the TV show Rami, and he talks about his experiences as a Muslim man in current America. And now we are able to show communities that, unfortunately, the entertainment industry didn't show for a criminally long amount of time. Tonight, actually, at the 92Y, I'm doing a talk with Rami Youssef. If anyone wants to go see that, it's 92y.org. All the money goes to charity. And Rami has done brilliant work, and it's really funny, and it's the type of work that we should have had 30 years ago.
Did you find yourself, your writing change after either the 2016 election or even as recently as January 6th?
I think that what it does is it makes you think about all of the divisions and how people are really fear-based. And sometimes that fear-based nature turns into aggression and hate and tribalism. So what it does to me is it makes me think, how can what I do bring people together? How can I make people want to be kind to each other? That's been maybe the core value in all of my work, is that everyone's struggling. It's really hard. It's hard to be a person. It's hard to get through everything and be good to people. It's hard to figure out how to connect and love. And maybe the movies are little examples of people figuring out a small piece of that. And one thing I like about The Bubble, the movie I just made, about people making a dinosaur action movie during the pandemic, which starts running on Netflix Friday, is that it's not a polarizing movie. There's no politics in it. It really is about what we all dealt with together, which is being alone, being in lockdown, trying to get along with the people around us, and trying to figure out how can we support each other during this time. Because the one thing that became very clear is, whether we like it or not, we are in everything together, and we have to lift each other up.
One, well done on the plug. Seamless. Seamless.
You got to get it in. I'm a pro. I've been in this thing 37 years. You think I'm not going to mention Rami Youssef at the 92Y? I am going to slip it in when you least expect it.
You're like, not a hobby, lady. Not a hobby. Let's talk about your movie, The Bubble, with David Duchovny after a quick break. This is all of it. This is all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Judd Apatow, whose latest directorial project is The Bubble, which premieres on Netflix tomorrow. The comedy tells the story of a group of actors of questionable talent and taste quarantined together in order to make the latest installment of the sixth of Cliff Beasts. It's kind of a cross between Jurassic Park and Sharknado. Though the cast is quarantined in a luxurious British hotel, pretty quickly the actors' behavior devolves. This film is a send-up of how and why Hollywood makes movies. Let's take a little bit of a listen to the trailer.
Welcome to the start of production of Cliff Beast 6. Thank you for joining us in our bubble.
Please make sure you're wearing proper PPE. Physical touch is, of course, off the table, so I would recommend making sweet eyes at each other. I'll show you what that looks like.
This is so exciting. It's like my movie posters have come to life.
You will soon learn to hate these people.
We are one of two movies in production right now. If we fail, the studio is going to go down.
I'm not a magician.
I know you're not a magician. If you were a magician, you'd pull a movie out of your ass. Oh my God, it's Minnie Driver. I love her.
This movie is going to make the world forget about all their problems. Ah! What we're doing is edgy. Ah! It's real.
Crystal just did a TikTok with a dinosaur.
The cast includes two members of the Apatow clan, his youngest daughter, Iris, who plays a TikTok star recruited for the new installment of Cliff Beasts, you know, get the kids, and then actor Leslie Mann, whose husband is Judd. She plays one of the stars of the franchise opposite David Duchovny, who stars as her on and off partner and the male lead of Cliff Beasts. He is convinced his rewrites can save the tanking project. The Bubble premieres on Netflix tomorrow. Judd's with us, and we welcome David Duchovny. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Hey, Judd, how you doing?
Hello, David.
David, your character says things like, "I'm sorry I skipped your mom's funeral to go to the People's Choice Awards." That made me laugh out loud. How would you describe Dustin Mulray when we meet him in October of 2020?
Well, I'll tell you the part, you know, that I relate to, that is also the part that's ridiculous. You know, as an actor who's been in various projects of descending and ascending world importance, you know, it's like I get the impulse to want to make, you know, the sixth installment of an action franchise save the world, you know, an ecological message, because we all want to infuse what we do with some kind of importance, you know, even when it's ridiculous. So that's why I could relate, and that's why I love the characters Judd brought him into being. Was, you know, the impulse is beautiful, but the person is ridiculous, you know, and not up to the challenge.
What's important to him? What is really important to Dustin?
Well, I mean, he says it's saving the world, but I think probably to be seen as someone who thinks about saving the world. I think that's what's important to him.
What did you see in the project that made you want to sign on, David?
Well, mostly it was Judd and the idea. You know, I've been circling with Judd for years now. I did Larry Sanders when Judd was, I think he was 13 years old, and writing on that show. So, you know, we've always kind of gotten close to working together and never have. And I was just so happy to kind of exist in his universe finally. I don't know if you know this movie, the TV set, but I played a character loosely based on Judd, or an amalgamation of Judd and Jay Kasdan. So, yeah, surprising. Wow. Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Well, that was a movie that we did that was based on all the nightmares we had trying to create TV pilots. And Jay Kasdan wrote and directed it based on a lot of my suffering.
Well, to that point, Judd, this film is clearly a send up of part of some of the aspects of Hollywood. You've got the overly earnest Sundance director, Fred Armiston. There's an actor trying to create his own sort of Scientology world, played by Keegan-Michael Key, the studio head of the film, the great Kate McKinnon, just not really caring what virus or disease or people losing hands or losing their minds, doesn't really care. What did you know you wanted to tweak about movie making, Judd?
Well, I think the funny thing was, part of what we were making fun of is the industry's need to continue work even as this calamity is happening. And we must get more movies done no matter what aspect of it. But then the joke is we were making a movie. So like we're making a movie, making fun of people who think you need to make movies while we're doing it. So it was like a meta hypocritical shoot.
It's called The Bubble, and it premieres on Netflix tomorrow. To that point, David, you have done something recent, these two recent roles. This one, Dustin, and then I thought the send-up of yourself in the chair was just great. And, you know, that takes a lot of self-awareness to play a male exactly lead playing a male lead who...
I'm not sure what you mean by send-up, but go ahead.
I'm acting. What do you like about sort of taking this sort of satirical side eye to the idea of the male lead?
Well, it's necessary, and if it's smart, it's good. And I'm always, you know, I'll send it up, but I'm also always trying to salvage, I'm going to just say the beauty of it or the heart of it, you know, and that's what I began by saying about Dustin, and I'm not saying that this is the major center of the film, but like if I can relate to the character's beautiful need, not his desperate need or his ridiculous need, then I can be ridiculous around it. And I would say both the chair, the character named David Duchovny, and this Dustin guy, as I'm saying, is like the human need is beautiful and tragic, and the result is ridiculous and funny.
Judd, you've gotten to see your kids be actors, do their thing. Iris in this film, and Maude in Euphoria. What have you observed about your children as adult actors?
Well, they learned very slowly since they were little kids, you know, doing parts in a lot of our movies. And I think they've just been around a lot of creative people. They've seen the process by being in the movies, but also by just watching me write and look at cuts for many, many years. So as adults now, they really know a lot and are very strong. And hopefully they picked up some good values about why we do the work, because I've tried, and Leslie's tried, to just pick things we're very passionate about. We really want to put things in the world that we're proud of. And I try to tell them that that's really the most important part of the job.
Is that hard to do?
It is, because you need a job, you know? And so sometimes the only job that you can get at a certain moment is the one that may not be good, that will pay you. And it takes a lot of thought to have a resume that you're proud of, and sometimes things don't work, but you know why you tried. And it's a scary business, because it's not regular. You're waiting for people to decide to give you a job. And like I say to all actors, try to write also, because then when you can't find a job, you can just write one for yourself.
My guests are Judd Apatow and David Duchovny. Their film, The Bubble, premieres on Netflix tomorrow. I mentioned so many of the funny people in this ensemble. David, what do you like about ensemble work?
I don't think I've ever been asked that question. I think in this case, because of the logistics of The Bubble, the movie, but also the bubble that Netflix would enclose us in, as was necessary. We hung out all day long. Nobody got to leave set. So all six of us, or whatever, however many of us were there early and stayed late, and were forced upon one another, you know, just to hang out all day. And that's not what I'm used to. And I really liked it. And it informed the kind of tensions that we were trying to get at, you know, on set as well. And Judd, I mean, I just have to say, Judd's patience is saintly and extraordinary, and I think it's one of the keys to his success, and one of the facets of his talent is his patience with comedians. I think with people trying to be funny, and he's just he's just there behind the monitor all the time, and letting things run out, and he's got his eye on the ball, and I'm just impressed by that.
Judd, what do you do when you're on set and you just know something's not working? What do you do?
I mean, that's really the only time where, I can internally, get very deeply concerned or have stronger emotions than I should have. But my process is built on knowing if that's going to happen before we get to set. So I write the script, and then we all have loose conversations about what the characters are like and what the scenes might be like. And then we do rehearsals and table reads and rehearse again. And so by the time we get to the set, we've actually figured out if the scene is worthy. And we usually have a lot of extra ideas that through those rehearsals that we've cataloged. So if we're doing a scene where Leslie and David are apologizing to each other for all the things they've done to hurt each other in their marriage, I probably have 50 of those, and I need six for the scene. And then David is improvising and Leslie is improvising. So a lot of my directing is fear-based. I assume when I get to editing, nothing will work, and I overshoot and get a lot of extra material.
I want to play a clip from the film. In the film, there's all these references to how COVID is being handled, how groceries are wiped down, COVID exposure coming from an assistant who had to get everybody coffee on the set. So let's listen to the scene where we learn cast members have tested positive for some things. This is from The Bubble.
Got some very important health news for you. You have all tested negative for the virus. However, some of you have tested positive for influenza. which is the good virus.
The good one, yeah. And two of you tested positive for two separate cases of sexually transmitted diseases.
Wait, how could we have got the flu? We've all been in the bubble.
We've narrowed it down to a delivery person and one of the gardeners, and we are handling it.
Well, if this is just the normal flu, I think we could just push on and complete the day, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Why? Actors are some of the toughest people I know. Amen. We can handle it.
Yeah.
I once played host to a 30-foot-long tapeworm during Cliff Beast 2, and nobody even knew.
I broke my wrist and my ankle on the last movie I did. I didn't tell anybody.
Good lad. That's the spirit.
I'm very concerned about Carol and Dieter, and I think they should at least have the rest of the day off.
All right, listen, we're not shutting this down for a bit of snot.
That's from The Bubble. My guests are Judd Apatow and David Duchovny. Judd, what did you want to, you know, it's funny, but also examine about the idea of how we all approached dealing with this pandemic?
I just found it potentially funny, our attempts to keep our lives moving forward regardless of how everything was crumbling around us. The illusion of our everyday lives or how we work or how we, you know, teach our kids. And, you know, we had to try our best to keep as much going forward as possible. And everything was going wrong. And we all lost our minds at different moments. There's a scene where Rob Delaney is playing the agent to Karen Gillan's character, and he just starts ranting about real problems. He's like, "You have actor problems. I have real problems. You ever try teaching a 10-year-old math on Zoom?" And I think that's what we all were going through. How can we still have some semblance of our normal lives?
David, I know it's not out until June, because it says here on my advanced copy, of your book, The Reservoir, which is your writing about life in the pandemic. Can you give us a little preview of what it's about?
Yeah, it just kind of came out of nowhere for me. I thought I was going to write a short story, and it extended into this short novel. And it was really just this, I was taking time-lapse photos of the reservoir that I live nearby in New York, of the sunrises. And then I just had this whole vision of someone like me doing that and then seeing like a light across the park, you know, like a window, one window in the pandemic kind of flickering at him with intent, he thinks. And then what happens when he pursues that relationship in a time of COVID, and it, does he have COVID, and is he going insane with the virus, and the kind of egotistical, you know, world history coming down through this one man as he devolves into his own madness as a savior of this woman in a tower across the park.
Why do you think it grew into a novella from a
hysterically funny, I might add.
Why did it grow into a novella from a short story? What
I don't know.
Got you? You don't know?
It just got longer. I'd never written a short story, so I just thought, you know, this was one voice. It's kind of an interior monologue. I just thought, well, how long can that really last? I thought maybe it was a short story, but then I just got into it, and it fell in this netherworld between short story and novel.
It's called The Reservoir, a novella. It will be out in June. I've been speaking with Judd Apatow and David Duchovny. The movie The Bubble premieres on Netflix tomorrow. Judd's book is called Sicker in the Head, More Conversations. That one.
Yeah. Oh.
That one, Sicker in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy, which is out now. Judd and David, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And see you all at 92 Wide tonight with Rami Youssef.
He did it again. Again.
Plugged again.
What a pro. What a pro. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.